understand a little bit about Kotel. How do you work with Marlon Kamos?
You want to finish the whole list? Okay, not to finish the whole list. A couple words of introduction to the introduction of the topic. That, as the veterans know, we love synergy. We love it when different things that we talk about interconnect. And this is an almost perfect opportunity. We have to talk about it for factors of timeliness. It's something that's going to be relevant to just before Rosh Hashanah, as in second or before Rosh Hashanah. So therefore, it is timely. But unlike any other year where we could choose from many, many, many timely topics, but because the Shemitah year only comes around once every 7 years, so it seems particularly appropriate that we choose that among the many timely topics to give some attention to. In addition to that, so in addition to it being suggested by the time, and like we mentioned, we only have 2 Sundays before Rosh Hashanah, at least 2 Sundays which we have Shir, unfortunately we have 3 Sundays, which is important, because the last, the third of the Sundays is the time by which you have to have the Kuzbol done, but we only have this and one other Sunday of Shir before Rosh Hashanah, so we're talking about it today. But it also synergizes in a lot of other ways. First of all, it involves the Beis Din and Eden, so therefore it connects to our general Sanhedrin focus. It also brings up some very pointed questions about what a Beis Din does, and therefore, what kind of Beis Din do you need? It also brings up questions of whether, theoretically, you could have a Beis Din of two, which is a sugya very early on in Sanhedrin, and how you relate to that sugya is very relevant to this question. So therefore, we're synergizing on that front also. But all of these synergies were just a little bit off, because we're almost up to those sugyas. It'd be a little bit better if we had done that sugya yet, but we need an extra week or two in order to get to that point. So we're just a little bit off with the synergy. It also brings to mind that one of the other major topics that's going to come up on Daf Beis and Aleph and Sanhedrin is the question of whether a get needs Beis Din. So on Thursday, when we spoke about many of the halachas of get that were alluded to in the parsha, so we almost had perfect synergy then also, except again, we're just a little bit off because we need to get to the Gemara's first that will tell us about, in that case, the Rashi and others who will tell us about Get and about the Beis Din of Two, about a number of other issues that are really going to synergize very well as soon as we get to them. So we're almost at a perfect synergy point, but we're just a little bit off. In addition to that, there are many other points of synergy that are relevant to this specific sugya, which I just want to call your attention to, so we'll have them in mind as we go on. Because one of the major considerations we already saw very, very briefly on our Daf and Sanhedrin is the concern of not discouraging people from lending money, and that is at the heart of the whole Kuzbol issue, and that was an explicit Gemara on Daf Beis and the Beis and Sanhedrin, that we don't want to be Noel Deles Bifnei Lovin. We don't want to close the door in front of lenders. We want the door to be open and to feel that they can lend money safely. So that's very much the essence of what Kuzbol is all about, and also very, very much relevant. This is so much, and there's so many implications of this Kuzbol sugya that I'm just trying to call your attention to all of that, and hopefully throughout the course of the Zman we'll be able to explore them more deeply. There is the question of the authority of Chazal, and we talked last week a little bit about Lo Sasser, a pasuk in Parsha Shoftim, and the question of the authority of Chazal to interact with Torah law, to perhaps on some level circumvent Torah law, to what extent are they able or unable to override explicit Torah law. Kuzbol is very often cited in that context, probably more often than anything else, and with apologies is often cited incorrectly. It's often basically held up as an example to say in the crudest fashion, that, oh, okay, Kuzbol shows you that the rabbis can get around the Torah whenever they want, so why don't they solve every problem just by doing whatever they could decide to do, and there won't be any other issues anymore left in Klal Yisrael. So halavai should be true. I mean, not halavai should be true. I don't want to say like that either. Not halavai should be true, because we assume that the Torah is perfect and eternal, and therefore we're not looking to circumvent it, but you know, the problems that we want to solve, we wish we could solve a little more easily, but, or sometimes at all, but the fact is that the authority is all within a framework of trying to maximize what it is that the Torah actually says and make sure that it's implemented in a way most consistent with the Torah's values. So we'll discuss a little bit what exactly Kuzbol is or isn't, but it is not an example of just the rabbi snapping their fingers and deciding, okay, we don't want this Torah law to apply, it no longer applies. It's far more complex than that, both in terms of its technical details, in terms of the basic facts, in terms of the mechanism, and in terms of the whole aim of what's happening. So this is all something that we need to understand better in a hashgafic sense. And it's a topic that, God willing, in future Sundays after Yontif, we'll discuss more head-on. The whole question of rabbinic authority, yes, the Gemara does say that the Chazal have the authority to override Torah law in certain cases. When does that apply? When does that not apply? What exactly is the mechanism there? It's a fascinating, fascinating sugya, all parallel to this issue of rabbinic authority. Kuzbol is very much part of that discussion. So God willing, after Yontif, we'll get into that a little bit more head on. It's one of our list of rabbinic authority topics to address. Okay, is that enough introductions? So the bottom line is there's about 7 or 8 reasons why talking about this topic ties in a very strong way to the broader themes of our Masechta, while at the same time being very timely as well. So today we'll just try to highlight some of the key points, maybe try to touch on some of the conceptual ideas, and then since we know we will be talking about other topics throughout the next few weeks that are relevant, we'll keep them in mind as we understand a little bit better some of the things going on. So, bottom line, Kuzbol is something that is a detail of the concept of Shemitah's Kesafim. Now, Shemitah's Kesafim is a complicated topic in and of itself. The Torah tells us that we have a mitzvah of Shemitah, and there are 2 forms of Shemitah. And we assume that this year, this past year that's ending in a few weeks, was a Shemitah year, and is the year that therefore has both of these sets of halachos relevant to it. I emphasize we assume, because there's a lot of discussion there already. Was this past year really a Shemitah year? So first of all, the Rishonim don't actually agree on exactly how to count, so there is some room to argue when Shemitah actually is, but we'll work off the premise that that's the case, this past year was a Shemitah year. And whether or not Shemitah is applicable on a level min haTorah, or maybe even at all, nowadays is a big subject of debate. So most of the poskim nowadays assume that Shemitah is midrabbanan, even though the Torah quite clearly speaks about Shemitah. But let's focus for a moment on Shemitah's karkos. But most assume that Shemitah nowadays is drabbanan. Now, why would that be? There's really 2 sets of reasons. And you may have heard people sometimes say that that's going to end soon, the idea of Shemitah being Rabbanan, because Shemitah is Rabbanan only when most of the Jews are not living in the land of Israel. And that demographically, we're on the verge of most Jews in the world living in Israel, and when that happens, Shemitah is going to be Min HaTorah. Have you heard people say that?
Yeah.
So it's not clear that that's really true. It could be very Zionist, that's nice, but if that were true, it's going to cause a lot of other ripple effects. So we spoke last year, and by the way, we spoke about this for a long time last year. If it's still of interest to people this year, I wouldn't mind on some future Sunday going through it again, but we did spend some significant time on it last year on the topic of the Het Mechira, right? The Het Mechira, which certainly has a lot in common with Kuzbol, but some very, very big differences. The Het Mechira is a far more recent device, which in a very crude sense is the parallel of Kuzbol for Shemitah's Karkos, for the land-based Shemitah. So we have a device which seems to ostensibly get around it. That's the Het Mechira. Het Mechira is highly controversial. We spoke about that at length last year. It's far, far more controversial than Kuzbol, because Kuzbol is in the Gemara itself. So Kuzbol is not controversial. It's only controversial when it's invoked in contemporary debate. But its existence is not a matter of controversy. While Het Mechira is very, very controversial. And again, if you want to revisit that topic, at some future someday. I'd be happy to, but it's a very long discussion. So the Hetz and Mechira, but just roughly speaking, it was started about 140 years ago. It was a great controversy then, and great controversy throughout. Basically, a mechanism by which land in Israel is sold into the hands of non-Jewish people. And the assumption being that if that's the case, if the land is owned by non-Jews, then it's not subject to the commandments of Shemitah. And therefore, one could continue to have this land work and to get produce from this land, even during the Shemitah years. Again, that's a topic which is a tremendous debate. We've mentioned it's a perpetual motion machine of machlokas because it contains within it the elements to be a constant machlokas, literally at Yisrael Tzedek, because every 7 years the question is revisited, and both sides say, well, you see how things have changed ever since the Hamas and Medina, ever since the economic realities have changed, ever since this change, whatever it is, and therefore, even whatever you said last 7 years, now you for sure agree with me. The other side says the same thing, that my opinion is a little more relevant because of what's happened since the last time we spoke about it, and even if you disagreed with me then, you should for sure agree with me now. So it's a constant, ongoing machlokas. But that's, so therefore, the very inexact parallel to Prusbol in the Karkos area. But all of that is premised very strongly on the belief that Shemitah nowadays is Drabanan. All of those who advocate the Het Mechira do so on the premise that that's the case, that Shemitah is Drabanan. Many of those who oppose the Het Mechira agree that it's Drabanan, and some disagree. So why should Shemitah be Drabanan b'zman hazeh? So it could be because Shemitah is connected to Yovel, and that Yovel requires Kol Yoshev Aleha, and therefore the absence of that, the absence of having all of the Jews living in Eretz Yisrael, so we don't have Yovel, and therefore we don't have Shemitah. That's one trend, that's one school of thought that you find in the Rishonim. Sorry? So that's based on a couple of things. I could discuss that at more length, but it'll take us a little bit far afield. So if you want to say like that, so then you might say, okay, so then is that the kind of case where if we have most of the Jews living in Israel, that point will flip? So probably not, because that particular svara, the Gemara says in the Maseches Erechim, that first of all, it has to be Kol Yoshevah, not Rov Yoshevah, not just most, but all. You have to figure out exactly what's going to take to be constituting all, but all. And it means all of them in their assigned places, in their assigned Shvat, in their assigned Nachlis. So that, for sure, we're not on the verge of having at least absent divine intervention. So that's not something that we anticipate al pi derech hateva changing anytime soon. The other svara that you find that's connected to Trumas and Maisris, and the Trumas and Maisris, so there we also have an idea of Bias Kolchem, that the Jews must be all returned to the land of Israel. So there, it is more possible that Rove is relevant, it is more possible if you have Rove of the Jews living, that could be enough. But there as well, Achronim explained that it doesn't mean that you trickle in. It means that if there is a mass redemption, if all of a sudden the Jews all get up and decide to go back, and it's not all of them, but it's most of them, so then that would trigger a return of Trumas and Maestros on the level Min HaTorah. So either one of those approaches leads one to say that Shemitah's Karkos is probably the Rabbanan nowadays.
All in that role.
Sorry, and both of them probably would not change because of Rove. The first one because you have to have also all and in the right places. And the second one, Rove probably would work, but Rove probably at once. Not Rove trickling in a couple of Nefesh and Nefesh, like with everybody going at once. And okay, there's some who don't go, but most go, so then that would probably do it. So the assumption that Shemitah's Karkos is the Rabbanan is what leads Het Mechira to then be suggested for a couple of reasons. Just again, this is not our topic today, Het Mechira, so I'll just highlight why it's relevant. It's relevant in a couple of different directions. It's relevant because the assumption that there's no commandments of Shemitah if the land is owned by non-Jews, that's itself a big machlokas in the Gemara in several places. And some assume that the answer depends on whether Shemitah or Trumas and Isis, whatever we're talking about, whether it's Deraisa or Rabbanah. That if there's a fee of Deraisa or Shemitah, then selling the land will make a difference. But if it's a Din Rabbanah, then selling the land will make a difference. So that's one reason why it's crucial to say that Shemitah is Rabbanah. Other reasons include a general attitude of kula towards Din Rabbanah that allow us to be more mindful with some of the mechanisms that we use, allow us to rely on minority opinions, allow other types of mechanism that we wouldn't so readily allow for mitzvahs d'oraisa. And another reason is that there's always a concern when we talk about anything like this, it comes up also in discussions of Mechiras Chametz, it comes up in other areas too, that there's a concern of what we call a harama. A harama means that we're evading the law, so to speak, we're getting around things. And sometimes it's very pejorative when we talk about it, and sometimes it's more value neutral. But, okay, you know, get around it by doing this, and that's the best advice, and sometimes, oh, you're terrible, you're engaging in a haram, or you're getting around what your real life responsibility is. So whether or not we are talking about any haramas here, that's a worthwhile discussion. But in general, we're usually a little bit more receptive to a harama if what we're talking about is drabah. And that comes itself, by the way, from the whole philosophical discussion, which we can have also in future weeks, that we believe in general that Torah law is more objective and conveys a reality, while many Achronim believe that rabbinic law is more about compliance, that you have an obligation to not rebel against rabbinic authority and to comply. And as long as you're complying, then you don't have to worry about further spiritual damage. Not everyone agrees with this, but that's a common approach. So if that's the case, you could say, listen, when it comes to harama, if you're dealing with Torah law, so we're dealing with reality here. We want to just do whatever is most consistent with the Torah's actual vision. When it comes with rabbinic law, we're more worried about not rebelling against rabbinic authority, and therefore we want to technically be in compliance. And one can argue that if we're technically in compliance, then we don't have to worry so much about whether or not it's completely within the spirit of the given rabbinic law. Okay, so far so good? Again, we're talking about a lot of things in very major generalities, which hopefully we'll fill in more as the weeks come. But is it clear? Is everything understandable so far? So that's another element why we care whether we're talking about deraisas, drabanas. Particularly when it comes to Shemitah, and not to focus on Shemitah's karkalos for a second, we are also more concerned about whether it's deraisa drabanan, because some of the opponents of the Hetta Mechira, they said, how could you act as if the whole crisis that came up in the late 1800s, where there were small groups of Jews living in pre-state Israel, pre-state Palestine, and there was tremendous financial pressure, and people were worried that they weren't going to make it, and that's why they were pressured to do this. So some of the opponents said, how could you act as if this is a new thing? We know, the Torah already knows that Shemitah is going to be hard. We know that we're asking a big leap of faith here. We know that this is not something that is easy to do, and yet the Torah says, "Bitzivisi esprachasi," God says that I'm asking you to do something not so simple, I'm asking you to take a big leap of faith. And yet, trust me, it's going to work out. So many of the opponents of the Hetta Mechira said, how can we defy this bracha in the Torah by saying, okay, now things are hard, so we're going to use this mechanism. So some of them responded. Avigdor Spengel said this. Avigdor Spengel, we mentioned his name a lot. He was a great Gaon who lived in Poland at that time. So some wrote that, and it's understandable, that the whole bracha that the Torah gives, that it's going to work out, that's when Shemitah is the right. That's when God tells you that you have to observe Shemitah. So then God is saying that it will come together with a bracha that everything will be okay. But if Shemitah is not min ha-Torah, so we're choosing to observe Shemitah for whatever valid reason, but it's not coming as a direct consequence of God's bracha and of God's sivui, so then it's fair to ask, are we still guaranteed this bracha that's supposed to come along with it? So that's what many argue, that separate from general questions about the harama, there is a specific issue within Shemitah that the bracha that will be okay through Shemitah is connected specifically to the Torah's vision of the mitzvah d'oraisa. And when we don't have that mitzvah in place, so then we're not sure the rest of it comes together either. And therefore, our responsibility is that we just have to kind of hobble through. We have to make it through until we can fully settle the land of Israel, until we can get everyone there economically safe and sound, and then bring about a full Shemitah Daraisa. And then we'll be able to have this bracha. So we have to do whatever it takes in order to preserve the structure of Shemitah, preserve the ability of Jews to live in the land of Israel, and then, God willing, we'll get to the day when Shemitah is Daraisa. I always try to emphasize when talking about that topic that in the Het Mechira debate, which again is not our discussion for today, this is the, by way of introduction, in the Het Mechira debate, it gets so intense and so vehement on both sides, it's important to appreciate the fact that both sides are really talking about the same values and the same ideals. Both highly value Yishuv Eretz Yisrael, they both highly value the mitzvah of Shemitah, they both highly value the well-being of the Jews, and they're trying to figure out how to get all the parts in place in order to best show respect to this. And so all the discussions of Shemitah, which always end, and it should be God's will that we should soon be able to observe Shemitah Daraisa, we want to add that it'll be more likely if we learn how to talk about it in a way that's respectful of both sides, in a way that recognizes that neither side is out to destroy God or Shemitah or the Torah or anything like that. They're out to try to figure out how to get us toward these values in the most effective way, and that's my focus, which should be addressed through the prism of Eilu Be'eilu Divrei Elokim Chayim. So, again, so much of this rides on the fact that Shemitah is Daraisa. Now, there is another review among the Rishonim that maintains that Shemitah nowadays is neither Daraisa nor Darabana, but is a Midas Chasidus. It's a matter of personal piety. So you could understand even more why that might not necessarily come along with any guarantee that everything is going to work out. However, because no sentence in that discussion can go without controversy, so there is machlokus in both directions, this position that Shemitah is only a Midas Chasidus, there were those who argued in both ways. See, some said, okay, if there is such a view, it's a Das Yachid, and because it's Drabanan and Shas Tzchak and the whole story, we can rely on Das Yachid. Again, that's part of the general Drabanan analysis that goes into that discussion. So there are those who argue in both directions. There are those who said it's not just a Das Yachid, but there are a number of Rishonim you could add to the list who believe that it's not Daraisa or Drabanan. And there are those who say, no, there is no such day at all. There's nobody who holds that Shemitah nowadays is a Midas Chasidus. That the only view in Rishonim that says that is really talking about Shemitah Sksafim. So that's what we want to try to discuss. So Shemitah Sksafim is the other half of the equation that the Torah says, together with this idea that you should not work your land, you should also cancel the loans. And that, the Gemara says, if you saw the Marma Komos, it was relatively early in the Marma Komos list, so that, the Gemara says, they should be connected to each other. That whenever the obligation of Shemitah's Karkos exists on a level in the Natorah, so then the obligation of Shemitah's Safin exists on a level in the Natorah. If there's no obligation of Shemitah's Karkos in the Natorah, then we have to figure out what happens to Shemitah's Safin. So it seems logical to say that Shemitah's Safin today, which differs from Shemitah's Karkos in that it seems to apply in Chutz La'aretz also. Shemitah's Karkos only applies to land in Israel, but Shemitah's Ksafim we find applying to loans in Chutz La'aretz also. But it seems logical to say that at most it should be a Drabanan. And that seems to be the view that the Shulchan Aruch takes, that Shemitah's Ksafim nowadays is Midrabanan. So we have to figure out, to what extent does that address the whole viability of Prisbul? The fact that a Prisbul exists, is that necessarily connected to the fact that Shemitah's Ksafim nowadays is Drabanan? It's also possible that Shemitah's Ksafim is even less than Drabanan. That's somewhat of a discussion. If you saw the Rosh and the Tshuva discuss the fact that when he came to his Drabanan, he didn't see anybody worrying about Shemitah. He didn't have Shemitah's Ksafim, he didn't see anybody getting their loans, and he wasn't 100% sure why that is, and he thought maybe it's because they all make it conditional. That the Gemara says in the Sefer Makos, also is on the Marma Komos, that there's a subtle difference that if somebody wants to make a loan on the condition that Shemitah's Kesafim doesn't exist, and Shemitah's Kesafim doesn't do anything to negate loans, then that's not going to take effect. But if somebody makes a specific condition on this loan, that I'm lending you this money on the Nas that Shemitah should not cancel this loan, so then that does take effect. So the Rush thought maybe the reason people in his tzibur were not getting rid of their loans is maybe they all made them conditional, but it sounds like from the Rush that he thought that really it should apply as far as he understands it. The Ramah quotes that Rush, and it's a little open for interpretation. If you saw the Ramah on the list, a little open for interpretation. Does the Ramah mean to say, really, we're not so sure it applies, or it does apply, we're just not so sure why people aren't taking it so seriously? It's a little bit vague. So there is some discussion to be had about is it possible to say that Shemitah's Kesafim doesn't even really apply in a level midrabanan? That's some discussion. And as we just mentioned a few minutes ago, so you see there might be Rishonim who make a distinction. There might be Rishonim who say that Shemitah Karkos is drabanan and Shemitah's Kesafim is not really obligatory nowadays at all. Now, why should you make a distinction between the two? So the Gemara in the Sefer is given, and this is very relevant to the whole question of how do we see the relationship between the Raises and the Rabbanans. So the Gemara gives you a little bit of a clue why. The Gemara in the Sefer is given discusses the whole idea of Prisbol, which already is explicit in the Mishnah. Right, if you saw the Mishnah in the Sefer Shavias, already tells us about Prisbol being an exception to Shemitah, so it's an institution that goes back that far, right? So we're talking about many, many, many centuries before anything like Hetzer Mechira, and even many centuries before most other such mechanisms that we have. We're talking about an order of magnitude older, and therefore far more established, but the Mishnah talks about Prisbol as an avenue, and the Mishnah also talks about it as a takana of Hillel. That Hillel was concerned, and here it's important to note that he's reflecting an attitude that is explicit in the Chumash itself. Right? The Torah in Parshas Mishpatim says that we're worried, the Torah calls such people blial, people who are really without any kind of conscience, basically. It's a very negative word, however you exactly translate it. But the Torah says in Parshas Mishpatim that there is an important mitzvah of lending money, that is a key obligation, and that if one fails to do so, he's missing on a major chesed. That the concept of chesed, if I ask you to name examples of chesed, there's all kinds of examples that may come to mind. We could talk about Bikur Cholim, and Achnas Sarfim, and Nichum Aveilim. These are all important chesedim that we sometimes omit, lending money, which the Torah identifies as a very major act of chesed that one can do. And in fact, Chafetz Chaim say for Avos Chesed, all about topics of chesed, a huge chunk of it is about that. That lending money is one of the major arenas in which there is an obligation of chesed. And sometimes you find that in rabbinic sources, in early rabbinic sources, when they're looking for one example of chesed, lending money comes to mind as the paradigmatic chesed. So the Torah is very clear that if it's possible, you're obligated to lend money when you can. There's all kinds of discussion we've had about that. That also we could have a separate date. There's a lot to say about it. But there are other mitzvahs in the Torah that also come to uphold this chesed. So, for example, we have a prohibition of ribbis. Those of you who have been in the business halacha class know that we spend a lot of time talking about that. That's a very important concept. That we have a prohibition to take interest, that we have to do this chesed without any such strings attached, which doesn't mean that you have to be lax with the principle. You have a right to insist the principle come back and to guarantee that the principle come back, but interest you're not allowed to take. It's a very severe Torah prohibition with lots of details attached to it. And you also have a prohibition of basically squeezing the guy. The Torah says that you can't pressure the guy to pay you back. The details of that are somewhat complex and outside of our scope, but there basically are two versions. That one, in general, even without Shemitah, you're not supposed to pressure a guy. Maybe it means that some understand if you know he doesn't have the money right now to pay you back, so you can't cause him discomfort about the loan that he has outstanding to you. And then more explicitly the Torah says, or more sharply the Torah says, that after Shemitah takes place, so then you're not allowed to ask for it at all. You're not allowed to, you have an obligation to say a Meshamit, and you have an obligation to absolve the borrower of the loan. So all of these mitzvos are surrounding this idea that we have a major mandate of chesed to help people out with loans when we can, and we can't take interest, and we can't pressure them, and any other such thing, and we have to cancel them in Shvia. So the context of that, the context is so important to understanding the motivation behind the system. So in the context of that, so Hillel saw that there's a pasuk in Chumash, that the pasuk says, people will say, Korva Shnas HaSheva, that we're afraid that somebody who could lend money when he's asked, said, listen, I'd love to lend you money, but it's coming too close to the Shemitah year, we're almost there, Korva Shnas HaSheva, and I'm afraid, I'm going to lend you money, I'm never going to get it back. So the Torah is harshly critical of that attitude and says you should lend money anyway. But Hillel saw in his day that it wasn't working, that people still were refusing to lend because they were not willing to take that risk of letting the Shemitah year come and having to lose their principal, having to lose the money that they loaned. So therefore, Hillel made this takana of Prozbul, which we still don't know yet what it is, but Hillel made this institution. Hi.
You able to see that? That like supports the opinion that the bracha that the Torah provides, and also this warning, only happens when Shemitah is deraisa and by Hillel is derabanan already.
Well, so that the Gemara then addresses a little bit. So whether it ties the bracha now, the bracha, it's interesting to what extent the bracha about Shemitah's karkos is relevant here. I think it might be hashkafically relevant in a different way, though, I guess a little bit far afield. But the question of deraisa derabanan is highly relevant.
And so even this, when the Torah says, like, it's a devar b'liyal, maybe that only applies when Shemitah is deraisa?
Maybe. Except that the problem is the b'liyal part is refusing to lend. So you're saying that if you want to take it a few steps and say that he's good, we have to build a couple of things on top of each other to get to that point. But in any event, so Hillel saw that people were refusing to lend, and therefore he instituted or made use of the pre-existing mechanism, depending on how you understand it, called Prozbul. So the question is, what exactly is going on here? So first of all, so the Gemara Masech is given. If you had a chance to see it. All these Gemaras, Lamevav, Lamezayim, start to get and talk about this thing. So the Gemara asks, how could Hillel do this if the Torah says there has to be a Shemitah? And if the Torah says one is supposed to be Mishame, so how could Hillel institute Prozbul and essentially get around it? So to this, the Gemara basically says that it's because Shemitah's Kesafim in the time of Hillel, and now, is Drabanan. So right away, that's a very important fact to be aware of that most of the people are not aware of when they say, okay, you see that you can do whatever you want to get around Torah law. So already the Gemara is assuming that if Shemitah was indeed the right, so Prozbul would not work. It sounds like Prozbul is premised on the assumption that it's Drabanan, and that that's the first step. Now, there may be Rishonim who might say that even Shemitah Deraisa, the mechanisms could have worked. But whether or not that's the case, it's clear that the Gemara certainly didn't take it for granted that Chazal could snap their fingers and work around Torah law, but that the opening assumption of the discussion is that because Shemitah is Rabbana, that's where Prozbul works. Now, we have to try to figure out, is that only addressing the mechanism, or is that also addressing the Hashkafa and the mentality behind it? It's also something that we'll have to keep in mind. Not at all. Not at all.
So I'm saying,
right?
Is he at that level? Of, I don't know. Like time-wise, chronologically, is he close enough?
So when you say avoid Rabbanan, it depends what you mean. You know, to say that, and we're talking about level. So to put the two words level and Rabbanan together. So sometimes the Gemara will say that in order for a later Bezdin to address or to undo what an earlier Bezdin did, then we'll start talking about level. We'll talk about Gadol b'chachma minyan, where they are greater either in overall authority or in numbers in the previous Bezdin. So that's relevant when the question is overturning a previous Bezdin institution. Here, we're not assuming that's what's happening at all. We're assuming that there is some other mechanism and device by which the conclusion is going to come out different. But even that much, is premised on the fact that we're dealing with rabbinic law rather than Torah law. Now, that itself could mean two things, and I don't think we're going to finish this all tomorrow, or finish this all today, we'll have to see, but maybe to keep continuity, maybe we'll continue it tomorrow instead of pushing it until next Sunday, and we'll just integrate it into our Sanhedrin meeting, I think probably to keep train of thought probably makes more sense. But there's two ways to approach just what that concept means. You know, we say that, oh, because it's Drabbanan, that's why this happened. So that works on two tracks. One is that the details of the halacha are more susceptible to such mechanisms because of Drabbanan, because of the general kula of Drabbanan, so we're able to do things we couldn't do for Torah law. But also it probably works on a philosophical track as well, that hashkafically, and this is a very important point which we'll come back to, that Hillel did not feel like he was undermining the Torah's value system because it wasn't in play in the same way. So to give a comparison to what we said about Shemitah's Karkos a few minutes ago, right, the relevance of Shemitah's Karkos being Drabbanan to Hetev Mechira works on at least two tracks, right? Because the details are Drabbanan, that's why we might be able to use the details of the Hetev Mechira. And so too, because the bracha of Shemitah that assumes you're observing it to the fullest extent of the law is relevant only when the mitzvah itself is deraisa, so also hashkafically there might be more room for the Hetev Mechira. So it's true here as well. When we say that we're working off the premise that Shemitah is Drabbanan, so we probably are addressing it in two different tracks. That the details work because of the infrastructure of rabbinic law as opposed to Torah law, and philosophically also that Hillel maybe would have been hesitant to institute this if he felt he was in any way undermining a Torah value, but because that wasn't the case, so therefore the room to do this was more apparent. And that's something for sure we'll come back to. So then the Gemara goes on to say that, hold on a second, Shemitah nowadays, Shemitah Tzafim nowadays, is Drabbanan? That bothers us. We have a problem with that. And this, by the way, is mega synergy if we were just a little bit coordinated better, because here's like an eighth point of synergy. I think we came up with like seven synergizing points before. Okay, here is an eighth major point of synergy. We should have started this mind a week earlier. It would have been totally harmonized. But listen to this next point. So what bothers the Gemara about that? Why is it a problem? The Gemara says, wait a minute, Shemitah's Ksafim Derabbanan? How could you have Shemitah's Ksafim Derabbanan? Why is that a problem? Somebody want to help me out? Why should there be a problem with Chazal instituting Shemitah's Ksafim? Shemitah's Ksafim Derabbanan. Why is Chazal putting in Shemitah's Ksafim? Why would that be a technical problem according to the Gemara? Because basically what's happening here, right? So David lent me money. David lent me money. You forgot that? Okay, good. So you're in the chemistry now. So David, let's say, theoretically lent me money. So I owe him money. This is not how Dos Bob did this as an example. All right, so let's say I owe you money. So now the Torah, if Torah says the loan is canceled, okay, it's canceled. By the way, parenthetically, we didn't even get into that. By the way, there's a whole machlokus for showing how Shemitah's Ksafim works. That according to some Rishonim, it's called Kosa de Malka, that the Torah just zapped them all out of existence, they're no chovos anymore. And according to other Rishonim, you are instructed to negate your loans. And it's still up to us to absolve them, but we do it. So whatever it is. So fine, on the Torah level, I can understand that. So just for safety purposes, I'll reverse the example. Don't borrow money from me. So fine, so the Torah says he doesn't have to pay me back. He's got to listen to the Torah, I've got to listen to the Torah, no problem. But if the Torah didn't say that, if there's no such din in place, so David borrowed money from me, doesn't the Torah normally obligate him to pay me back? Right? And wouldn't one think that he's possibly in violation of lo sigzol if he doesn't pay me back? How could that be? So now you're going to tell me that the rabbis can come along and say, you don't have to pay me back? How can the rabbis come and tell David not to pay me back when the Torah tells him, he's a gazlan if he doesn't pay me back? So you see the issue? Right? What right do the rabbis have to tell David not to pay me back when the Torah says, if he doesn't pay me back, he's a gazlan? Okay, so here's the point of the super synergy, which we're just a little bit off. The question of, is it really gzela to not pay back a loan, or is it something else? That is a topic very early on in the first mission of Sanhedrin. So keep that in mind for super synergy within the next few days. We're not there yet, but that's one of the very first topics in Sanhedrin, together with whether a get requires a bezin, the Olshan of Tiron Delphi Lovin, bezin of two, five other principal topics that are all going to be super synergized into this first mission. So that's one of the major issues that we'll get up to before all these others. What really is the Isser involved in not paying back the loan? But it seems like that's the case. It seems like there is an Isser for David not to pay me back. And here you're going to tell me that the Chazal came and made a din d'rabbanan and you should pay me back? What right do they have to do that? Right? So this is fascinating, again, because it's very different from what the world thinks. But that's what the problem with the Gemara has. Not that Tuzbul undermines Torah law, but the other way around. That Shemitah's Ksafim d'rabbanan undermines Torah law, because really he should be obligated to pay back his loan. So that's the question that Gemara asks. So now the Gemara has two answers to this question, two possible answers, Abaye and Rava. So one answer is Shev al Tasa Shaimin. That somehow it's better, maybe this isn't full-blown Lo Sigzol, maybe it's just some other reason why it's better, but somehow we're better off because David's not actually reaching into my pocket and taking money, but all he's doing is passively aggressively, not paying me back. But somehow the passivity involved is better. Don't get the sense that, oh, we're asking him to rob me, we're just asking him to not pay me back. For some reason, that's better. What exactly is the reason? It's a much longer discussion. We'll have to show for a later date what exactly are the implications of that statement, of the Shev al Tasa. But we won't focus on that so much right now. We'll focus on the other answer, which seems to be a little bit more direct. The other answer in the Gemara is Hefker Bezdin Hefker. That apparently Chazal, or the rabbis, how exactly we define Bezdin, again, our central topic here, but what the Bezdin are talking about is a question. But somehow the authority of Bezdin allows them to shift around monetary control. So that probably is the more relevant answer for our purposes. Now, just parenthetically, you see here that if we said before that there are some Rishonim who might maintain that Shemitah's Karkos is Drabanan, but Shemitah's Ksafim is not Drabanan, it's Midas Chasidus, we can understand now why. Right, because you could say, all right, Shemitah's Karkos, that can exist as a Drabanan. We could say that the Torah tells us not to work our land, or we could say also that the rabbis say don't work the land. But Shemitah's Ksafim, because it involves these complex interpersonal issues, it's kind of got to be all or nothing. Because you could say either it's Daraisa, and therefore we're both obligated to recognize the cancellation of the loan between the two of us, or we could say it's a Midas Chasidus, and I could be a nice guy and choose to cancel the loan. But we could see why there's no in-between. Right? We could see why we can't say it's a Drabanan, because then you're going to have the Drabanans going up against the Torah law. Torah law is you have to pay me back, the rabbi is telling you not to pay me back, that's going to get complicated. If you want to tell me voluntarily, I can choose on my own to start canceling my loans, Midas Chasidus, okay, fine. But for the rabbis to say it has to be, in defiance of the Torah law, which requires you to pay me back, that gets sticky. So we could understand why there might be a distinction, that when everything is Daraisa, so then Shemitah's Ksafim and Karkos all go together. When it's Midrabanan, so then that gets a little more complicated, and Shemitah's Karkos can exist, Shemitah's Ksafim maybe can't exist. So that's perhaps that view in Rishonim that sees it as a problem. So the Gemara essentially is asking this question. That's what the Gemara says. How could you have Shemitah's Ksafim Midrabanan? And the Gemara has these two answers. That either we're going to say Shev al Tasa somehow makes a difference, or Hefker Bezdin Hefker. Now, if you want to utilize Hefker Bezdin Hefker, so then that's going to be a big question. How exactly Hefker Bezdin Hefker is going to make a difference? How exactly is Hefker Bezdin Hefker going to enter into things? That's something we're going to have to figure out. Okay, so essentially, what we have in place is we have a concept of Moser Shtarosov LeBezdin, that the person who has the loan, the person who is the owner of the debt, in other words, the creditor, the lender, so he can give his shtaros over to Beis Din, and that will create a situation where Shemitah is not going to absolve the loan. Now, it sounds like, from the Gemara, we'll go into more details of the Gemara, we'll have to continue this tomorrow, and we'll just review in a second, but it seems like from the Gemara is that this was a concept in HaTorah. That in HaTorah, this always existed. That if somebody handed over his chovos to Beis Din, that Shemitah would not negate the loan. Now, what does that mean? On a level in HaTorah. Rav Asher Weiss has a whole essay about this. Maybe that could have meant, we don't know this to be the case, maybe that would have meant, let's say somebody who wants to make a donation of his loans to Beis Din. Right, we know that theoretically there's a concept of transferring debt and selling debt happens all the time, both in halacha and in contemporary economics. Right, somebody who is holding on to a bill of credit from somebody else can sell that to a third party. So maybe that's what we're talking about. Right, maybe we're saying that somebody owes me $100 and I decided that instead of collecting $100 for myself, I'll donate this bill of credit to the shul. And now the shul can collect it, so it's a way of making a donation to the shul. So maybe that's what it means. Maybe that's what Moshe Shtarosu of Tebezdin means, that if I were to do that, then the loan wouldn't be canceled. It doesn't sound like that from other sources, though. Theoretically, it could make sense, but that doesn't seem to be the case. It seems like there is some difficult concept to understand that if somebody hands over his shtar to Tebezdin, so then Tebezdin will own the debt, and the debt's not going to be canceled. Now, why should Beis Din want to do this in the first place? Is Beis Din choosing to be a collection agency for private citizens? It's not, if it's not, that they're going to profit from it, or in profit meaning on behalf of the Tzibor, but if it's not, that they're going to be able to benefit the Tzibor, but basically they're acting like a collection agency. So in theoretical circumstances, that could make sense if a person, let's say, is defaulting. So yes, it is Beis Din's obligation to protect people from being exploited, and if somebody is borrowing money and not paying it back when he should. So that seems to be one of the functions of Din that we've been talking about the past few days, if that's the case. But it's also not clear that that's what we're talking about here. So we have to figure out exactly what is the abstract idea of somebody handing over shtaros to Beis Din. But it seems like that was the premise for Hillel. That Hillel took that concept and applied it to Kuzbul. So you may have seen, if you saw them on the Komos, Machlokas, Rashi, and Tosfos, is it the same din? Is it a different din? The Mishnah mentions them separately, which makes it sound like it's two separate dinim. Moser Shtaros LeBeis Din and Pruzbul. It seems like Moser Shtaros LeBeis Din is a din Torah, Pruzbul is a din Drabanan. Maybe it just means Hillel told everybody to do this, but that was his takana, but the concept always existed. So that's a big debate. But somehow, I'm just speaking broad ideas now, we'll go into more details tomorrow. It seems like essentially one hands over the debt to Beis Din, and through that, the loan will be able to still be collected after Rosh Hashanah. So there's a lot to figure out, which we'll have to pick up with tomorrow. So how does that happen? First of all, what's necessary in order for a person to do that? What process is necessary? We find also that the borrower must have some land in order for this to work. How exactly does that operate, and why does that operate? What kind of Beis Din do we need? What kind of circumstances are required in order for this to work? And what is the basic lumpus of the mechanism? So Beis Hashem, all of that we'll have to pick up with tomorrow. So just to quickly review what we spoke about today, and please don't hesitate to ask if you have any questions. So we talked in broad strokes a little bit about the question of the interaction of rabbinic authority and Torah law, and about the fact that Pruzbul is very often, perhaps unfairly and incorrectly, been held up as an example of the ability of rabbis to almost do whatever they want in order to address circumstances in Torah law. And we saw that it doesn't seem to be the case. We talked a little bit about the parallels between the Hetta Mechira, which is a far, far later innovation and far, far more controversial than Pruzbul, but in a very crude sense, they're parallel. Both are rabbinic plans to change the result of one of the types of Shemitah. So we talked about the question of whether Shemitah is the rights of Rabbanan, about the relationship between Shemitah's Tzaf and Shemitah's Karkos, about the Gemara that says that the two of them, if they're both the rights, if one's the rights, they're both the rights, but otherwise not. We talked about whether Shemitah Shvitas Karkos is Daraisa Darabanan, and why it might be Darabanan, the two different tracks, and why that's so important to the idea of Het Mechira possibly working, both technically and hashrafically. We spoke about it at some length. And then Pruz Balasa, we saw how that was linked to the same kind of questions, and also the Gemara taking the premise that it only works because Shmitas Ksafim is Darabanan, and how that premise probably is true both technically, halachically, and hashrafically as well. And then the Gemara asking the question, highly relevant to Beis Min Aleph and Sanhedrin, why is it that the Chazal can tell you not to pay back a loan if the Torah seems to obligate you to pay back a loan? And that creates the whole problem for Prisbol Drabbanan, really for Shemitah Drabbanan. And the Gemara has the two answers to how Shemitah Drabbanan works, either through a Sheva Al-Tasa process or Hefka Bezen Hefka process. And we have to figure out why that makes a difference. And then we started talking about some of the basic elements of Prisbol, about the need for a Bezden, about the idea of turning over your Shtar to a Bezden, about whether it's the same halacha as the general giving your Shtars to Bezden, or whether it's something else. What kind of Bezden do you need? What kind of Eidim do you need? How many Dayanim do you need? Why is it that there's a mysterious requirement for the borrower to have land? So Be'ez Hashem, we'll pick up from there tomorrow. I wish everyone a wonderful day. We'll convene in the next 15 minutes for Mincha. And it should be all good things.